to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Joining me from across the bay in the East Bay is George Kelly. How are you doing?
Just fine. It's the sunny side of the bay, and it's very sunny over here. You guys probably have some sun today, too.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a very mild winter, and so I'm going to assume that it's going to be a mild spring and be really sweet as well.
The only thing we've had to worry about today is the solar storm. All the headlines are screaming about the flare that's reaching Earth today.
Yeah, I had heard that there was a that you could actually see the like a Northern Lights experience in the Bay Area, which is very bizarre.
Wow, I'd only seen headlines that talked about Illinois and maybe Idaho and some of the Rocky states, but really here, I need to get on that.
Yeah, I think it was like you had to be up at 2 a.m. or something to watch it, but that's just to me that's pretty amazing because that seems like something you'd only see in really north. Up north or Alaska or something.
I've never seen the Northern Lights. Have you?
No. I tried once. I was in Alaska for a wedding in March, and it was a little late in the season even then to see them, but you know, I never got to see them, but I've heard they're just amazing. So today we've got kind of an interesting, definitely action-packed show with a lot of good guests and a lot to talk about when it comes to tablets, newspapers, magazines. The big news is about Apple and its new iPad that's coming out that everyone thought would be called the iPad 3, but I guess it's just the new iPad. What's your experience with tablets and you know what you guys are doing with tablets at your newspaper?
Well, there is a big initiative, cooperation with a company called Tackable to make the tablet, the iPad, and useful for gathering news and crowdsourcing news with regard to events. There's also a lot of work that goes into a twice daily updated iPad edition of the paper that people can sign up for, download an app for, and subscribe to. You know, there's lots of publications that have thrown a lot of resources and dedicated a lot of time and energy and staff to those publications. And we hear a lot about the Condé Nasts of the world, but we haven't heard as much about the newspapers. But, you know, I'm sure that will flip over time.
Definitely.
I spent a lot of time staring at the screen, like a lot of people yesterday. I wasn't watching a live stream or any of the live blogs. I was sort of peering in using a tool called Storify to peek at Instagrams and status updates from other networks. And it was really interesting to sort of shoulder surf people's reaction to the feature set as it rolled out, including, you know, the building heart-pumping anticipation towards the end of the new name. And then to find it was, you know, it's not the iPad HD, it's not the iPad 3D, it's just the iPad. And
the new iPad.
Yes, because, you know, somebody made that very interesting point that this is probably going to be a lot of people's first iPad if they if they decide to make that move. I don't own one. I don't own an iOS device. I joke that my wife and I are in a mixed marriage. She likes her iPhone. I have my Android device.
And you still can get along.
And we give each other tips to troubleshoot and offer, you know, technical service. I don't know that I'll feel drawn to an iOS device. I mean, perhaps there's going to be some mind-blowing stuff coming down the line in the fall. Whenever iOS 6 drops.
So we'll talk about the iPad, the new iPad, and we'll have a couple guests on Mac enthusiasts, Mac, definitely some people who've been covering them, Leander Cani from the Cult of Mac blog and Tim Carmody from Wired. And then we'll turn to a report from the Project for Excellence in Journalism and Mark Jerkowitz, who will talk about some research that they've done about newspapers and just their difficulties in changing their business over to more digital versus print. And then finally, we'll have the new editor of NewYorker.com, Nicholas Thompson, who comes from the Atavist and has been a senior editor at the magazine, the New Yorker magazine, and now is kind of going to take over as editor of the website. So we'll see what he has in store for NewYorker.com. First, let's start with the new iPad and the announcement that was just made very recently by Tim Cook, CEO of Apple. Everyone is expecting it to be the iPad 3 or iPad HD, but it's just being called the new iPad. We don't know how long that'll last. The new features, the headline features are a Retina display, which is an amazing, very, very high resolution display with 4G connections, a faster A5X chip. The price is the same as what the iPad 2 was. It's starting at $499 and going up, depending on whether you're going to get larger hard drive sizes, whether you're going to have the 4G connection. The iPad 2 will continue to be out, but will be have a price cut to $399. And it's also Apple announced it's upgraded a lot of its software for the iPad. And it says it's announced three it's sold 315 million devices running iOS to basically everyone in the country except for you, George.
60% of what was the figure? 90% of all tablets and 60% of all mobile traffic is
Is iOS.
yes.
It's pretty amazing. So let's bring on our guests and see what they have to say about Apple's latest announcement. Leander Cani is editor and publisher of the popular Cult of Mac blog. He's former managing editor and previously a senior reporter at Wired News. He's also the author of three books centered on subculture surrounding Apple products, as well as the company itself: The Cult of Mac, Cult of iPod, and Inside Steve's Brain. Welcome to the show again.
Thank you, Mark.
And Tim Carmody is resident book futurist at Snark Market. He's a senior writer for Wired and Wired.com. He's written occasional pieces for Neiman Journalism Lab, The Atlantic, and a bunch of other places. He's a dad, recovering PhD and postdoc in comparative literature and literary theory at Penn. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Mark.
So the new iPad is the name of the new iPad, I guess, for now.
Right.
That just seems bizarre. Do you guys have any insight into why? Is this just like the default? Like, we couldn't come up with any numbers or letters, so we're just going to say the new iPad? Like, I don't know. This is just bizarre. It's almost like a generic name or something.
Well, it actually follows their naming conventions for their other products. The iMac doesn't have a number. The MacBook doesn't have a number. So they're returning to their form, and this is kind of Apple. I think when Steve Jobs is around, they would have called this Apple's marketing genius because they kept things very simple. And it actually makes kind of sense because if you walk into an Apple store, you can say, I want to check out the new iPad, and no one's going to be confused year after year. You can keep saying the same thing, and it keeps things nice and simple.
Yeah, and I think if you look at other consumer electronic products too, like Kindle updated and their new $79 Kindle isn't called Kindle 4, it's just called Kindle. Even though they had, Kindle 1, Kindle 2, Kindle 3, and they've got the Kindle Touch and the Kindle keyboard. So they have different ways of differentiating that don't have anything to do with numbers. I think eventually people will just call it iPad. Right now it's the new iPad because they're still selling the iPad 2 and because it's new. But I think this is the idea, is that it's just, again, like Leander says, just like iMac or MacBook. It'll be called iPad. It's a little tough. I think the press is a little upset just because partly there was, some talk about iPad 3 or would it be called iPad HD, but mostly just because we want to try to find a way to refer to these things and you know, writing the new iPad over and over again, just, I think it grates on people. So that's why I think you're seeing some people who are extra crabby about the name change, just because they want an easier way to refer to it.
And I mean, what do you guys think about this kind of new version? I mean, it feels like Tim Cook is being stuck with these kind of these aren't very revolutionary. They're kind of just minor changes, it feels like, to us. But then again, you know, with the iPhone 4S, it was kind of panned as not being that exciting and not being that great, and then it had this huge success story. So is that happening again?
I think people are crazy. look at this device. It is astonishing for a consumer device. It shoots 1080p HD video, which you can not only edit on the device with this fantastic editing suite, you know, iMovie, plus a bunch of other third-party apps, you know, to do all kinds of different things to it. And then you can share it at near broadband speeds wirelessly. And it's completely integrated with this whole, you know, universe of apps and, you know, all this amazing software that is so easy and intuitive and actually a joy to use in most cases. It's more powerful than most gaming consoles. It has a better screen than most, you know, of the biggest, fanciest TV. And it costs less than $1,000. I mean, it costs $800 to get the fanciest one. I think people are mad. It's absolutely amazing.
I mean, are people really using it to shoot pictures and video? I mean, I've had mine for a while, and I think I've maybe shot pictures a few times. I mean, is that something that people are using, or maybe will this make people use it more that way?
Well, they will, like just like the iPhone 4S, you know, that is now the most popular. It's more popular than most point-and-shoots. I think it's safe to say it's the most popular camera on Flickr, and because it's a good camera. The ones that came previously weren't good enough, and this one is you know, the same camera. So, yeah, I think you're going to see people shooting like crazy, and it's the world's biggest viewfinder. I mean, it's a great viewfinder for taking digital pictures.
Yeah, and I think you'll see people using it a little bit differently. I mean, you'll have people, you know, doing video chats with their kids. It won't be, you know, it's not portable in the same way, but it's still, you know, completely useful device. And again, I think this is Tim Cook's style. You know, he's not going to be the guy who goes out there and proclaims that, you know, he's reinvented a new product category every year. He's, you know, it's about opening up new markets. It's about making the product work better. It's about being able to deliver, you know, kind of unprecedented screen resolution and keeping the price the same. I mean, these are gigantic achievements, even if they don't necessarily, you know, jump up at you in the same way that the iPhone did when it was first announced. It's as a consumer technology company, Apple is just firing on all cylinders right now and doing everything well, and it's exactly because of Tim Cook.
So the argument is that I was struck yesterday by Jolie Odell's VentureBeat take. She said that the press conference called showed a brand unraveling. You're suggesting that it's more of an evolution, more of an adaptation to this new leadership.
Yeah, I mean, Josie said, you know, Josie took issue with some
Jolie,
of the things.
Jolie.
She, you know, she, for instance, the slogan on it was revolutionary. Which, you know, is kind of a crummy pun. And, you know, she sort of said, you know, Steve Jobs never would have greenlit that. It is great that everybody can ventriloquize Steve Jobs from beyond the grave, because everyone knows exactly what he wouldn't have done. But at the same time, you know, resolutionary, you know, not to read too much into it, but that's not a bad word for what it is. And that's right. Not a bad word for the way the company is adopting. Both it is the better resolution of the screen and the video camera, and it's also this idea that it's going to be evolutionary step forward. It's going to be steady improvements. It's going to be sort of continued strength. I again, like Leander said earlier, if these things were happening, you'd have probably the same proportion of people. The same things are happening under Steve Jobs' watch, you'd have the same proportion of people calling Steve Jobs a marketing genius, and also people saying the Apple cult is through, the brand is finished, they've failed to deliver again.
They said exactly the same. It's exactly the same modus operandi that that operated under Steve Jobs. Look at the iPod, the evolution of the iPod. It was actually quite a big fat brick when it came out and fairly primitive. And it ended up, you know, going through to becoming a very, very sleek device that was improved year after year. And of course, Jobs was no stranger to hyperbole. Every year he would say, this iPod, the newest iPod, is the most revolutionary iPod that we've ever shipped. And he would get the same criticism.
Yeah,
people would say exactly the same thing. You know, this is ridiculous. It's a disappointment. I want an iPod that makes me a cappuccino. you know, this is the end of the company. And, you know, look where it is.
Yeah, and even again with the name, you know, the name issue. If they had called it the iPad 3, there would have been just as many people saying, "Why? How dare you call this an iPad 3? Even though it's only an evolutionary product. It's at best an iPad 2S."
Right.
So it's kind of these things where you can't really win either way.
So what about with publishers and with media companies and you know that part of the kind of contingent of people who work with Apple. What does this mean, having kind of such a high resolution, so much, it seems like it's a real media player device in a way, and also with all this kind of editing and photo editing and video editing, that it's going to really be a killer kind of not only to watch more video and watch more kind of, let's say, TV and movie content, but also to kind of play around and manipulate your own material.
Yeah. It's
all, go ahead, Leander.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. It all has to do with the software. And, you know, of course, the first iPad didn't have a camera. Now they've added a camera. Now it's a video device. My kids, you know, they hijack my iPad all the time to make movies. And they've actually filled it up. I mean, I was trying to install some updates yesterday, and I couldn't because it was full of all my kids' movies. So when I deleted a few, we got the new iMovie, which has a lot of really fun trailers. You can make these fake movie trailers using video that you've shot. And so we made one in about 10 minutes last night, and we're playing around with it in front of the Apple TV. And we had a blast. We had a super fun, you know, playing with this thing, and came up with something really quite creative in 10 minutes. And there are all these different apps where you can add special effects and do different transitions and share this stuff online. And the kids are totally into this. They're posting this stuff to Facebook. It's. I think, you know, before we didn't really have this wealth of software, which is starting to see in the App Store now, which is making it much more of a creative device. And then one of my writers took his iPad to the Mobile World Congress last week and used it to report from Mobile World Congress. All the pictures, all the copy, all the editing that he did was all done completely on the iPad. He didn't touch a laptop the whole week.
Yeah, but at the same time, Leander, you know, touches on a point, which is that, you know, these videos, whether you're shooting in HD or downloading an HD movie, they can fill up your hard drive really quickly. And the iPad hard drives have not gotten bigger. You know, someone said on Twitter the other day, I don't remember who it was, but, you know, it's like Moore's Law is lumpy when it comes to flash memory. You're not getting, you know, it isn't going to 128 or 256 gigs, at least at the same cost. So this is where I think the fact that Apple is pushing the cloud, that it's doing cloud backups of the movies, of your movies, both for Apple TV and for iPad, is going to be a really big deal. I mean, this is something Amazon has already been doing. This is something Apple's already been doing with music to match in the cloud. But it's really necessary once you move to this high resolution, because otherwise the files just get so large. App files are going to get larger, media files are going to get larger, photos are going to get larger, magazine files are going to get larger, and really the only way that you can cope with that without getting a bigger hard drive is to start to stream those things, to back them up in the cloud rather than keeping them all in your device.
Is this also an opportunity for services like the G Drive, if that ever arrives from Google, or Dropbox?
Right. Yeah. Dropbox is going, you know, gangbusters. It's very popular, and there are all sorts of. I mean, you can buy these Wi-Fi enabled. What are they called? Network attached storage devices for storing content locally, and of course, you can use your. Apple tries to get you, to use your Mac still as the hub, the digital hub. So it tries to encourage, you know, if you're. I mean, you're really supposed to manage the content that goes onto it, you know, through iTunes, and it's still a bit clunky because they still haven't quite transitioned into this full iCloud world. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a good point. You know, iCloud is increasingly important, and in fact, you know, all my music collection, I mean, 60 gigs of it lives in the cloud now, and I'm supposed to stream it. I've had nothing but headaches with it, to be honest. But mm-hmm. yeah, cloud is super important.
And there are even some interesting things. Like Apple didn't announce this, but I just posted a story at Wired about this, where there are companies that where if you buy a DVD or you buy a Blu-ray, you can get an iTunes authorized digital copy. You know, there's a copy that you file and there's a code that you enter through iTunes. And Apple will actually back these files up to the cloud for you as well. It's not just the ones that you buy through iTunes. So Apple, I think, is really positioning itself as through iCloud. It really wants to move as many people to iCloud as possible, and to really have that be the way that you share, particularly these media files, which not only are large, but they are the kinds of things that you are more likely to use across all of your devices. Dropbox and iCloud and Google Docs and G Drive, they're going to all have their places for, you know, syncing files and sharing files between people. But in terms of the kind of personal media consumption, it's really Apple and Amazon that are pushing this idea that, you know, do your purchases and store your material with us. We'll keep it in the cloud, and then you can stream it anywhere you want, anywhere on devices that support our software, which are, you know, in the case of Apple especially, is usually Apple devices.
No question. Well, thanks, guys. Appreciate you joining us.
Sure, pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Thanks, guys.
All right, well, let's turn our attention to newspapers and their future and what they're looking at as far as digital models. And let's bring on Mark Jerkowitz and see what he has to say about the study. So Mark Jerkowitz has been Associate Director for the Project for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center since 2006. Before that, he spent 20 years covering the news media at the Boston Phoenix and Boston Globe. Welcome to our show.
It's nice to be there.
So you guys just came out with this survey, and it was kind of an interesting survey where you talked to more than a dozen media companies who put out 38 different newspapers, and you kind of got them to give you some inside financial data on how they were doing as far as print, digital, where they're spending their time, what the culture was around digital, but they weren't. None of them identified themselves, I guess, in the quotes that you used in the research. One of the problems that you found was that out of the people that you talked to, for every dollar that they gained in digital income, they lost $7 in print. And also that just 40% of them are doing targeted online ads, and they're having a lot of difficulty when it comes to kind of becoming more of a digital culture. And especially in sales staff, that the digital sales staff just isn't really up to snuff at a lot of these places. What is that? Does that kind of characterize some of the top lines of what you guys learned?
It does. Let me just state, because we had a couple of layers of research. We ultimately had six different newspaper companies agree to have some of their individual papers provide us with proprietary data.
Okay.
We ended up with almost 38 papers giving us proprietary financial data, largely about their digital advertising efforts. Once we had that data, we then went to those six executives at those six companies and another seven companies, for a total of 13 companies, to make sure what we were seeing was fairly representative of what was happening throughout the industry, and also to give some context to those numbers. And yeah, I mean, the key finding, the one that's completely unavoidable, is the transition from this old business model that was reliant on the digital on the legacy product to a new digital environment is going slowly and is a real struggle. We found overall in our sample that for every $1 that these newspapers had gained in digital revenue for the last year, which they had data completely available, which was 2010, they were losing $7 in print revenue. So in other words, they're still sort of hemorrhaging money in this attempt to sort of cross the bridge from legacy media to digital media.
Was there something in those that had that kind of loss? I'm sure there's differences among the different places you talk to, but the ones that really had that kind of hemorrhaging, was there something about them? Was there some characteristics about them that like kind of became clear to you, like, why that was happening to them?
Well, I think it's clearer to actually see some of the cases in which that were doing better, in which we had outliers on the other side. And I can tell you just from looking at this data, there were some companies that were performing certainly better than average, far better than average. That there were a couple of companies, as a matter of fact, I shouldn't say companies, newspapers, individual newspapers, that in that last year had both digital and print revenue growing. That's a real accomplishment. There were a few more that essentially were almost matching their print losses with their digital gains. And there are some characteristics we are starting to see that these papers have in common. One of them is that they are making efforts to expand into these more digitally oriented advertising platforms. One of the things we found in this study was that there's still overall a heavy reliance on the two forms of advertising that basically carried the print product, display and classified. Even in the digital sphere, that accounted for about 75% of the digital ad revenues. There was minimal, low single digits in things like smart targeted advertising or video advertising, very little at this point mobile advertising. So some of the successful companies we saw were ahead of the curve on making efforts to sell smart or video advertising, and were also ahead of the curve in starting to generate revenue there. One other characteristic that we're starting to see among these positive outliers is that they are involved in sort of developing non-traditional revenue models. And by that we mean it's sort of taken for granted that in the digital world you're not going to replicate the old 80% advertising, 20% subscription formula that works so well with the print newspaper. And advertising isn't going to work the same way online that it did with newspapers. So it's already a saying that there's no magic bullet, that there are going to have to be a series of different revenue streams. So we found that a number of papers that are doing better are experimenting with these new revenue streams. The most common one is sort of establishing their staff to sort of function as a digital agency with their own advertisers and local merchants, meaning not only are they trying to sell them products, but they're actually acting in a way as online consultants for their own, for their merchants in their community, helping them develop their websites, teaching them search engine optimization, involved in reputation management or working on social media. So they're beginning to branch out in new forms of businesses as well. And the other thing
That's funny because that whole idea that the newspapers would become kind of almost agencies. I remember it was, I think the Newspaper Association of America did a survey a while ago, maybe a few years ago, and I think that was one of the bigger conclusions they came to, is that newspapers need to actually do that in their community.
They do. Like, now, it's interesting. There certainly is a strong suggestion that can work effectively. We've seen some newspapers generating significant money. Having said that, it's interesting. Among the executives that we interviewed, there was a real split verdict on whether that was the way to go in the future. There were a number of executives who said candidly, look, our staffs are stressed enough. You know, we don't actually have the competencies to do this well. So it's not a universally, at least the digital agency concept, is not a universally embraced concept yet. But we did find in our sample that almost half the newspapers were trying something like that. So that is interesting. And the other thing that we found among some of the positive outliers is that they are doing interesting things with retooling the sales staff. You mentioned that. It's one of the things I came away with, from this work and these interviews and the surveys really convinced about was how important it is. It's something you sort of overlook when you write stories about how the news industry is doing, but how important it is to sort of retool a sales staff that frankly has, used to selling a print product, has people on that staff who were around from the days of the 20% profit margins when you could basically pick up the phone and just take orders, and now they're being asked to learn essentially a whole new landscape, learn the jargon, learn the different digital products, be able to start to have conversations with advertisers and merchants in their own community who are not familiar with that product, and then close deals.
What do you have to say about culture? Because as much of pushing a rock uphill as it can be to get sales folks involved, editorial is also
It's interesting that you mentioned that. to me was what, frankly, one of the surprising findings, and this came largely from our interviews with the executives, but we basically asked the 13 executives, you know, can you tell us what the single biggest challenge is within your company to sort of making this successful transition to a new business model? And they didn't all use the same exact language, but fundamentally, they 11 of them said the same thing, which was it's essentially this internal tension between, you know, those who are pushing faster to move into the digital future and those who are more steeped in a legacy tradition. And it doesn't always mean that the newsroom is the one lagging behind. In some cases, people cited the newsroom. In some cases, people cited the sales staff. In some cases, people cited people at the top of the management chain. So there are just, you know, these pockets of tension and resistance within these organizations. They vary. One fellow said, you know, I'd say we're 75% of the way there to having, you know, getting everybody sort of eliminating that tension, that cultural tension. Another fellow told me we're about 25% of the way there. But the fact that this is still an internal dynamic that hasn't completely been resolved at this point, I think, is interesting. The other thing that makes it somewhat understandable is there's kind of an irony here. While newspapers understand that the future is digital and that that's where they've got to put their efforts and they've got to expand, at the same time, right now, on average in the industry, 85%, every 85 cents out of every dollar made by these newspapers is still coming from their legacy product, their print product. So at the same time that they're teaching this mantra of pushing digital, the truth is right now the checks are signed and the bread is buttered from that old, you know, slowly decaying legacy product.
Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate you joining us.
And sure, my pleasure.
We're going to have Nicholas Thompson come on from, he was the new editor at NewYorker.com, and if you want to hang out and talk to him.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
So Nicholas Thompson is the new editor at NewYorker.com. He was the co-founder of The Atavist and a contributing editor, is currently contributing editor to Bloomberg TV and CNN International. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
So we were just talking to Mark about the study done about newspapers and their kind of their difficulties they've had culturally in just dealing with digital transition. You're at, you know, the New Yorker, obviously a very strong legacy media player. What's it like there as far as doing a digital transition, and where are you guys at right now?
I think people are pretty excited by it. I mean, there are obviously a lot of people who have written for the magazine for a long time and written in print, and they're now being asked to write for the blogs, for example. But they seem up for it. I sit next to Roger Angel, who wrote his first piece for the magazine before my father was born, and he is, turns out, a terrific blogger. So it's going pretty well culturally.
So tell me about where you guys are at. You know, you've done a lot. You started out putting, or the New Yorker in general, before you were there, I'm guessing, you know, started putting like just bits and pieces online. Now you're, you know, you've got blogs, you've got video, you've got this great politics section. What do you think what do you think about what you'll do with it? Do you want to have more online only content and original online content? Is that where you think you'll go?
I think we will go there. I mean, what we're doing right now is there's the print magazine and then there's the iPad app, which has been a huge success with a couple hundred thousand people using it. And that replicates what's in the print magazine with some digital extras and extra videos, documents, and other cool things that you can add into it. Then on the website, we publish about 30% of the print magazine each week. So we hold a lot of stuff back. We don't want people to, you know, assume that everything we write will be available for free on the web, but we do put some stuff out there. And then we add a whole lot of web-only content, so blogs, original content written by staff writers, people responding to the news. My guess is that in the future, the balance of content will stay about the same. We'll probably put about the same amount of our magazine content on the web, but that we'll also have a lot more web-only and exclusive web content. People have been, you know, getting more enthusiastic about writing for the web. We've had people shift over. John Cassidy used to, his contract required him only to write for the magazine. Now his contract, he writes for the website every day. I think you're going to see more of that.
Will you actually put that in the contracts for people that, you know, anyone that you hire moving forward will have both kind of magazine and print and online kind of requirements?
I doubt it. I don't think we'll, certainly not everyone we hire moving forward will have that restriction or have that requirement. I think that there will be lots of people for whom it's a component. Some people we have on staff now, Ryan Lizza, for example, he was all print until, I don't know, 6 months ago, and now he's a mix of print and web. You know, we'll figure out the right match for different, you know, different writers have different metabolisms. They're good at different things. We need different things online from what we need in print. So it's going to be a constant mix, a constant balancing act. And, but I think in general, you know, the new staffers and new writers we bring on and the people we have here are going to be spending, you know, a higher percentage of their time writing for the website.
If I can throw a question out there, this is Mark Jerkowitz. Obviously, when you're, you know, you're talking about what you're doing on the web now, the web is a great way to sort of spread the brand, and I assume also, you know, sort of a gateway into the magazine for a lot of people. To the extent you've thought about it, do you see at least potentially the web product also being in some ways a significant revenue generator going forward?
Oh, we would hope so. I mean, I should add the hedge to all of these answers that I actually haven't started the job. I start, you know, next week, so my knowledge of, you know, our master plan and what exactly is going to happen is going to be a little limited. But yeah, I mean, we're making, you know, we're getting sponsorships, we're getting ads, we're getting you know, good CPMs on the site. My hope is we make lots and lots of money off the web. Obviously, advertising online is a tricky business. There's, you know, lots of content and, you know, not as many advertisers looking to put their ads on that content, and everybody shares that problem. But, you know, we hope with our distinctive brand and our writers and I hope distinctive content, we'll do pretty well.
Hi, this is George Kelly. Do you find yourself feeling drawn to any of the particular newer class of apps or platforms that are coming out? I'm enjoying following Spotify playlists that Sasha Ferrer Jones will put together.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there's a lot of interest in apps like platforms like Pinterest or even newer capabilities that the newer class of apps that are expected to be hits or popular at South by Southwest are tapping into.
You know, obviously we're, you know, developing our Pinterest strategy, which is complicated. We have, you know, different strategies for all these different platforms. We have, you know, interestingly enough, I think different from some magazines, we have a huge success on Tumblr. We have a great Tumblr presence and lots of fans. I mean, like everybody else, we're deep into Twitter, deep into Facebook. I am not sure where I'm going to want to put our energy or where we're all going to decide we want to put our energy. So I'll hold off on that question, but if you ask it again in 6 months, I hope I'll have a really good answer.
Nice one. So what about, you know, long form content online and in digital platforms? You know, we went from a time where everyone said, oh, the web, it's all this bite-sized blogs. It's just tiny. There's nothing very smart going on there. And now it seems like there's this push for kind of Kindle singles, and there's so much great long form content. And now, you know, there's this technology that just helps us kind of save everything and aggregate and get advice from people. It just seems like I don't know if this is a renaissance of long form content or just people thinking of it in a new way.
I think it's a renaissance. I love it. I was told recently by the founder of the Longreads hashtag that I'm the second most neurotic poster to the Longreads hashtag on Twitter, which I was very, very proud of. I mean, I think there's a reason for this, right? Which is that for a long time, the web just got shorter and shorter and snarkier and snarkier. And it's very hard to compete against that. But if you can produce content that's long, that's fact-checked, that's edited, that can't be produced for free, you have something original and something unique that people are gonna look for. One of the other parts of my life at the Atavist, that was the whole principle of it. The reason why the Atavist does long form narrative journalism and only long form narrative journalism is because there's a sense that the rest of the web, the free unpaid part of the web, can't do that, right? So you can actually make money on that. And I think one of the reasons why the New Yorker has had success with its long form stories, I mean, every month our most read piece this month is Ian Parker's incredible story about the Tyler Clementi case. The reason why people want to read that is that it's A, great content, the web makes it available, and you can't get it for free at any of the other sites. It's something we do well, we do distinctly, and we can succeed there. So I do think it's a renaissance. I think it's, you know, obviously very good for the New Yorker. I think it's I think it's also, I think it's good for the world that there has been all this excitement over a long-form narrative, complicated thesis.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you all.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank my co-host, George Kelly, as well as our guests, Leander Connie, Tim Carmody, Mark Jerkowitz, and Nicholas Thompson. And we want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to tune in for all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab, as well as our new site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week for our special South by Southwest report.